sitting opposite me, watching me get the needle, and it's happening right this very, very second. God, I'm brave. Is a fellow who hasn't been in for a while. His name is Angus Grigg, National Affairs Correspondent at the Fin, otherwise known as the Australian Financial Review. And the last time he was here, I think you were exposing the dodgy contracts that went to Paladin in relation to the detention centres on Manus.
That's right. And in fact, we had a bit of an update on that story. Their colleagues over at Nauru got another couple of $100 million last week, actually.
So you keep an eye on old stories as well as cooking up new ones, do you?
People tend to, you know, tip me off when things are going on, and someone very nicely from Amnesty International gave me a call and told me about the Nauru contract the other day. $200 million, $10,000 a day per refugee.
Lovely to have you back. Insider trading, often perceived as a victimless crime, particularly by those who were caught doing it. Back in 2014, two young fellas were arrested after the biggest insider trading investigation ever undertaken by the Australian Federal Police. At one point, 80 police officers working on the case. They freed them up from raiding the ABC, which shows how important they viewed this story. And so here's Angus, who's now doing a podcast which is going to tell you this gripping story. It's called The Sure Thing. The first episode is available to download. Now, Angus, I know nothing about the stock exchange. I've never bought a share in my life. I've got no damn idea. So you've got to help me before we get stuck into the story. What is insider trading? How does it differ from outsider trading?
I don't know. I've never been asked that before. I guess basically insider trading is the passing of confidential information from an insider, someone either inside a company, to someone else who then uses that to have a market advantage to trade on.
In other words, you're just being friendly.
Well, there is certain markets around the world where people say they wouldn't trade unless they had insider information, but...
Okay, what's the scale of insider trading in a backwater like Australia?
Look, it's pretty hard to put a figure on that, but I guess there is, if you sort of comb the Fin most days, you will see stories about stocks running up prior to company news being announced. So you'd have to say it's pretty common. There is a lot of it goes on, but there's probably only one or two cases each year which are prosecuted.
So it's basically impossible to know the scale of it.
Yes,
let
absolutely.
Alone put a figure on it.
I guess you would say in defence of ASIC, you know, the corporate regulator, that the burden of proof on insider trading is very, very high. And so suspicion that something is going on is not proof of insider trading.
I understand that what we're about to discuss was slightly different in that it was insider trading on a currency market.
Yep, the only known example, certainly in Australia and probably in the world.
Well, that fills me with a sense of patriotic fervour. I'm so proud that we're on the cutting edge of something.
We were the first.
Righto. Okay, so let's now start being logical here. Tell me about Chris Hill and Lucas Kamei.
So, yeah, I guess these are the two sort of main protagonists in our story. And they were university friends. They studied commerce and economics together at Monash University in Melbourne. And then about 2 years after graduation in 2013, they get together with a group of friends at a beach party on the Mornington Peninsula. And this is really where our story starts. And at this point in their lives, Christopher Hill is working at the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and Lucas Kamei has worked at Goldman Sachs and is now, or at that point, is a currency trader for the National Australia Bank.
And so they're doing all right in their respective fields.
Both of them have very, particularly Lucas, has a very good job. You know, we describe him as a master of the universe in training. He is he's earning $200,000 a year at that point in his life as a sort of 26-year-old, 25-year-old. Chris Hill's doing pretty well. He's got a graduate job at the ABS. He's earning sort of $80,000, $85,000 a year.
Now, you and I are hiding in the bushes, okay, and we're listening bits of conversation, And we hear Lucas suggest that they could make some money if Chris could give him the employment data, which sounds very boring, before it was publicly released. Why could that possibly be of interest?
Yeah, so this is, we go back to our beach party at the Mornington Peninsula.
Where and you and I hide yes, in the bushes.
Yeah, we're hiding on the beach there. And Lucas lets it be known that he could use the information that Chris has access to, indeed, which Chris is compiling for the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And that is, I guess, so crucial because that determines the level of the Australian dollar. So each time one of these pieces of key economic data is released every month, you will have a reaction from the Australian dollar. It will go up or down depending on whether the data is weaker or stronger than expected. And so Lucas, working as a currency trader, knows that if he can get this information before, he can place trades in the foreign exchange markets and he can make a lot of money.
Now, the idea was to keep the investment small so that no one would notice. They'd be under the radar.
It was a good plan. It was a bomb-proof plan that they cooked up, that they would commit sort of relatively modest insider trading, $200,000. They would do it over a period of 12 months. They would do some winning trades, some losing trades. They would split the profits, $100,000 each. They would pay some tax, good citizens, and then they would never speak of this again, as they said. But that, of course, didn't quite happen.
And they sort of dulled any pangs of conscience by having the view that insider trading was, yes, a victimless crime.
Absolutely. And that's and Chris says that very clearly, that he never, first of all, he didn't give it a lot of thought because that he was committing a crime, that he was essentially, you know, corrupting the ABS, and also that he didn't see anyone getting hurt. And so that is the sort of, I guess, one of the rationales or the justifications that people, or the stories people tell themselves about committing a criminal act.
Would the ABS have a reputation for fidelity, for circumspection?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was the only time in their 120-year history that anything like this had happened. In fact, it was, I guess, the people that worked there were so law-abiding, if you like, or just sort of outside that the realm of using this information, that they didn't really even have a lot of procedures or controls in place because nothing like this had ever happened before.
Now, eventually, Lucas makes just under $8 million from the information. How many million bucks did Chris make?
Yeah, well, this is the sort of betrayal of the story, right? That Chris makes $20,000 at the time they're arrested. Chris has been given $20,000, and Lucas has almost $8 million.
And you reveal, and you know, it's all about, it's all in the 6-part podcast. You reveal that ASIC and the AFP were on to the trades very early on.
Yeah, this is the, I guess, the other sort of element of this story. There's the sort of Chris and Lucas cooking up this sort of bomb-proof plan. There's this betrayal. But then there's also this police chase. And, you know, as I was saying earlier, the burden of proof is so high on insider trading. That's why they had to devote so many resources to it. And they spent, you know, 3.5, almost sort of 4 months trying to crack this case. And there were sort of times when they were, you know, saying, you know, the main officer said, you know, that he would run around with his underpants on his head naked through the office if they actually got the information on Chris and Lucas, because they were quite good in how they operated. They were very disciplined in not contacting each other. They didn't sort of meet up or socialise outside of their offending. And they used these, you know, so-called burner phones to disguise their activity.
Now, Lucas makes $7.8 million. Chris makes $20,000. He wasn't even trying. I mean, if you and I were to go into something together, we'd go 50-50, wouldn't we?
Well, I mean, this is the thing, I guess, that really intrigued me about this story was that usually in a sort of criminal enterprise, and if you and I were to cook one up, Philip, you know, we would typically be bonded very closely.
We would.
right through the offending.
Siamese twins,
yes, indeed. Yeah. And this is what you know. You usually see in this thing that the criminal enterprise progresses through, and you know the two or the people involved are very loyal to each other. Usually, right until the end, until they get caught, and then you know things descend from there. But in this case, and this is the most fascinating thing I think about it, is that Lucas betrays his friend at the first available opportunity.
Because I'm addicted to The Sure Thing, your six-part podcast.
Thank you.
Well, once you hear it, and we're going to play a bit shortly, once you hear even a grab from it, you can't escape. It's just so exciting. Now, the first trade, September the 13th, they were arrested in April 2014, and both of them go to the slammer, but this is where the 50-50 thing breaks down again. Chris goes for 2 years, Lucas for 4.5. Given the disparity in income, shouldn't Lucas be in there for life?
Well, look, Lucas did get the longest insider trading sentence.
Yeah, but not much, you know.
Well, he got 7 years and 3 months. He served about almost five. That's a pretty long sentence, and he served it a lot of it in a sort of reasonably high security prison, which, you know, are not nice places.
But this is interesting. What you're suggesting is that very few insider trading things end in conviction. But even if you are convicted, you're not going to do a lot of time.
Well, I think this is the perception. And look, this is not my sort of area of study, but one of the people on the podcast, Clinton Free, who's a professor out at Sydney University, and he's looked at a lot of this. And his view is that in terms of the sentence handed down for white-collar crimes as a percentage of the maximum sentence available, that actually they're fairly strong, that the prison sentences handed down for white-collar crimes are disproportionately higher. And I think it goes to this sort of idea around the sort of betrayal and the breach of trust for society that people in privileged positions commit such crimes.
Can I ask you an inside question, not a trading question, but
okay.
How did you lure Chris Hill into talking to you? Did you use drugs or hypnosis?
Look, it was a long process. None of those things. We did have a few beers and discuss it. I think, look, Clinton, who I mentioned, introduced me to Chris. He has sort of spent his time travelling around interviewing prisoners about why they offend. And so he introduced me to Chris. And look, I think from Chris's point of view, he wanted to tell his story. He probably wanted to change the narrative a little bit. That it was out there, put his offending into context and probably try and sort of draw a line under it and start again, I guess.
Something has fallen off the back of a truck. It is, in fact, a grab from your podcast. Oh,
here we go.
I've got to give him a gesture.
It was just a two-day piss-up, really. Just hired a house and I think we went to the beach one day. It was just 10 or 12 people with a heap of grog. Basically worked doing the employment figures and, you know, he at the time was working for NAB on the foreign exchange desk. I can't remember exactly how it sort of happened, but he sort of jokingly said that, I can use that information or something like that.
I'd like you to describe these people to me as human beings. Let's start with Chris.
Look, Chris is a very, quite a shy guy, I think. He's not the sort of life of the party in any sense, but I think he's a person who has a lot of friends. He's got a lot of, he's described as sort of overly loyal by some of his friends we speak to. His maths teacher, his former maths teacher, said that he was the smartest kid that she ever taught in, 25, 30 years of teaching. He was a guy that probably, went out a bit too much at uni, didn't quite get the marks he needed to pursue a career in finance and ended up in a job that was okay but pretty mundane at the ABS, that working with a lot of people who he describes as sort of book smart.
But he wasn't in any sense a thrill seeker.
Look, I think a part of his, the reason that he decided to sort of engage in this criminal enterprise with Lucas was that Yeah, it was some thrill-seeking to it, and I think he was probably a bit enamoured by Lucas. He wanted to be in Lucas's sort of good graces and aura, I think.
Now, Lucas sounds like a tad narcissistic.
Well, and that's exactly the diagnosis in his trial. And, look, he was a... Lucas was a sort of classic private schoolboy, really, investment banker. He was, you know, pretty sort of charismatic, quite good looking, pretty popular with the girls, that sort of guy, not bad at sport. He won the university medal at Monash University for commerce and economics. So he's a smart guy. He gets a graduate job with Goldman Sachs.
They would have come looking for someone like this, wouldn't they?
Absolutely.
They would have been recruiting the best and the brightest.
Yeah, I mean, he would have got one of, you know, probably four or five jobs that year from everyone who did a course like that at university. So, look, he was definitely on the fast track and he was sort of destined for big things. And I guess one of the sort of pivotal moments in his, you know, very brief career was that he was made redundant at Goldman Sachs in the fallout from the global financial crisis. And I think that probably had a pretty big impact on him.
Has he come rushing to you to take part in the podcast?
Look, we're hoping Lucas will talk to us. He hasn't at this stage. We've been sort of talking to some people in and around him. But, you know, I think it would be, I think he's got, you know, something of a story to tell. I think he's, you know, he spent a long time in prison. We've talked to some people that he was in prison with. And, you know, I think... You know, he's trying to sort of rebuild his life out of prison, really.
Tell me this, how has Chris been affected by the slammer?
Yeah, look, he's pretty circumspect, I guess. The one thing that really surprised me about Chris was that he wouldn't say a bad word at all about Lucas. He won't say that Lucas sort of betrayed him. He won't say...
He doesn't say that.
No, it's fascinating. And you know, in the sort of 6 or 7 hours of interviews, you know, it was a real point of frustration that that he wouldn't say anything bad about Lucas. And I was just stunned by that, really. And I guess they have... Lucas and Chris have a bond. Not only that they sort of committed this criminal act, but also that they spent a long time in jail together. They spent 96 days together in the one cell.
Bonded.
Yes.
Getting back to that.
Yes, indeed.
Well, that's terrific. Now, Angus, you've done a good job here. He's the host of the podcast series The Sure Thing, and his day job is National Affairs Correspondent for The Fin, the Australian Financial Review. And if you stick around, Angus, I'm going to introduce you to a real live spy. Talk about insider. This guy worked for the French version of Mossad. Stick around, and he's coming in through. Oh, that jab hurt. Okay, spy next. Helen L. RN.